episode 41 of the podcast, I talk about stuff with a notable sector leader, Professor Craig Mahoney, who is Vice Chancellor and Chief Executive of the University of Law. From growing up on a farm in Tasmania, Craig came to the UK to study, ending up at Queen's University Belfast to complete his doctorate, before taking up a series of academic posts and ultimately becoming Principal and Vice Chancellor at the University of the West of Scotland, a post he held for 8 years. Craig rightly feels a sense of real achievement from his time in charge at UWS, which he's taken forward into his new role at the University of Law, a very different kind of institution, which has a long history, but a different operating model as a private for-profit university. Craig and I reflect on when we first met on the then Leadership Foundation's top management programme, and note he's the only one of the TMP 17 cohort to go on to be a VC. We also talk about his passion for teaching and the different approaches required, including the technological innovations developed in response to the pandemic. Craig trained as a teacher, but also spent a few years leading the Higher Education Academy. When he arrived at the HEA, around 25,000 academics had teaching qualifications or equivalent, and this grew to 75,000 during his tenure, and has since increased to over 100,000. We also explore Craig's thoughts about the biggest challenges facing the sector, which range from the need to be sensitive to the concerns of young people, the importance of a more grown-up debate about what universities are trying to achieve, getting to the right age participation rate, and the major funding issues facing both individual students and the sector as a whole. Finally, we discuss the essential place of sport in university life. Craig is also chair of Bucks, and the many benefits it brings, particularly to students' mental health and well-being. And then we explore the important relationship between registrars and their vice-chancellors, of course. Anyway, this is the first time I've spoken to a VC on the podcast, and I'm delighted it was with such a great character. I do hope you enjoy listening. Right, welcome everyone to the latest episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time it's my enormous pleasure to introduce Professor Craig Mahoney, who is Vice Chancellor and Chief Executive of the University of Law, and indeed my first ever Vice Chancellor on the increasingly erroneously named University Registrars Talking About Stuff podcast. So welcome, Craig. It's great to have you.
Hi, Paul. Great to be here.
Right. Well, Craig, we'll talk about how you and I first met in a moment, but can we just rehearse a bit of your career history before you end up at the University of Law? Because, you know, you've had a really kind of varied path through higher education, and starting in Tasmania, which is a very long way away and a place I hopefully will visit someday, but ending up in spending quite a lot of time in the UK. So talk us through that journey. How did you end up here?
It's a really unexpected journey, Paul. I don't think I could have ever imagined growing up on a farm with parents who left school at the end of primary school, age 11, that I would sometime end up in the UK working and leading a university, now two universities. Quite a phenomenal outcome as far as I'm concerned. Look, I went through normal education at school. I wasn't a great student. I wasn't a poor student either, but it required some effort and diligence. My brother got a place in university, and because we were very competitive, I decided that I was going to go to university too. And that was the pure reason why I went to university, because we were competitive. And I studied the subjects that I was good at, which were the sciences and maths. And so I did a degree in chemistry and maths as a sub-major, and loved that. And then I subsequently started teaching for a while after that. But at the same time, I was also playing professional sport. I was playing squash on the sideline, and that was my real passion. There's no doubt about that. And at one stage, back in the last century, I travelled to the UK and played squash here professionally for a period of time, got an injury, went back to Australia, started getting more involved in sport, and didn't get a job at the Australian Institute of Sport that I was desperately keen to get, and was advised to come back to the UK and get a master's degree in sports science and come back and the job would be mine in Australia. So this career journey brought me to the UK. I did the master's degree at the University of Birmingham. I was offered a PhD place as well following that, which was very flattering. I only knew one person who had a doctoral qualification before that, which had been my maths lecturer at university. And so I started a PhD, but I was self-funding, and that was pretty expensive.
Yeah.
So I decided that I couldn't continue doing that. We did apply for research funding. We did actually win some research funding from the Health Promotion Research Trust, Margaret Thatcher's repurposing of taxation money on cigarettes. But my supervisor was...
Few people remember that, I think. Yeah, of course. So it's a nice little footnote. That.
Yeah, and of course, it will actually date what I'm talking about. Yeah. And so because he then rejected it on moral and ethical grounds, even though he'd been suggesting we apply for it, I was left being unable to fund myself. So I went back to squash again, went to Scandinavia and played and coached and worked there for a while and managed to get a job in Northern Ireland where people weren't terribly keen to go at the time as a research assistant. And so went to Queen's University as a research assistant, subsequently got a full-time lecturing job there, and completed my PhD at Queen's. And so that started a career journey, which meant return to Australia was probably less likely. And you know, other things happened too. So children came along and partnerships developed and so on. And I started working my way through the UK higher education system as firstly a lecturer at Queen's and then a senior lecturer in Leeds and then head of department in London, a dean in Wolverhampton, a deputy vice chancellor in Newcastle. Then I stepped out, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, as chief executive of the Higher Education Academy. I then became vice chancellor at the University of the West of Scotland and now at the University of Law, as you described. So, yeah, an unexpected career journey. And I'm very proud of what I've achieved in having been in all academic roles that a university would have. So I think I've got a good understanding of that. And I'm a research and teaching academic. So I'm proud of the journey, but it's not where I thought I'd end up. And, you know, Tasmania on a farm to the UK as an academic and leading a university, phenomenal.
Yeah, no, it's an incredible journey. And I'm always interested in people's backgrounds, but that is remarkable. Well, we're glad to have you in the UK, Craig. West of Scotland, then, that university, because it's mainly based in Paisley, but has other sites as well. Mm. You're there for 8 years. So it really grew during that time. So how do you look back on that now? A sense of real achievement there?
Yeah, I'm very proud of my time in all my institutions, actually, but very proud. When you're the chief executive and the vice chancellor of the university, you'd like to think that you can leave the legacy, not associated with yourself, but with the university being in a better place than when you got there. And I think that's demonstrably true of my time at UWS, which previously, for those who know the history, it was called the University of Paisley until 2007, when its name changed. So it became a university in 1992, along with incorporation across England. And it mainly was only on one campus, as you say, in Paisley. But then it grew, and it grew before I arrived there. So there was a campus when I arrived in Dumfries, very small, in Ayr, modest size, in Hamilton, quite large, and in Paisley, very big. And in my time there, I opened a London campus. We subsequently moved to a new facility about 3 or 4 years ago. That's been a great success. So there's over 2,000 students on that campus in London now. And in Scotland as well, all the campuses were able to grow, despite the fact the Scottish system is a capped system.
Yeah.
So student numbers are not eligible for increase within the capping system, but you can internationally recruit as many as you want to. So we did increase our student body by over 7,000 students in my time. Turnover increased by over 30%, and other metrics improved as well. Now, I happen to be the leader. I'm not sitting here saying that was all because of me, but certainly I gave a vision and a belief and an opportunity for those things to take place. And for that, I'm extremely proud.
Yeah, yeah, quite rightly so. So you and I first met when you were at Northumbria, yeah, and we were both on the what was then the Leadership Foundation's top management program, back in around 2008, something like that. So it was TMP 17 was our cohort, and it was a very interesting group to be part of, and it was you know, great to get on with all those people. But I think you were are you the only person who went on to be a VC out of that group? Not that everyone aspires to be a VC, of course.
The TMP program was very important to me in building friendships and relationships with people who had a variety of roles across a broader range of universities than I was typically linked in with. And you were one of those people as a registrar, but there were HR directors and there were other people in different roles. And it was great to be part of that group and still is great to be part of that group. We still meet as often as we can. I am the only person out of that group to become a vice chancellor, which I think is really unfortunate. And as you will know, and others may not, but in TMP 17, four of our colleagues unfortunately passed away, all within a very short space of one another. And there is no question in my mind that three of those were possibly on the pathway to becoming vice chancellors.
Yeah.
Two of them particularly very close to that. So the tragedy is that there were more people in that group who could have and should have become vice chancellors. And of course, you shouldn't exclude yourself from that, but we did lose four members along the way, and that's a real pity.
Yeah, it is, and we do miss them. Yeah. And we'll park the discussion about registrars becoming VCs for now. But you know, I'm sure lots of us are very flattered by that suggestion, Craig. On the issue of different kinds of universities. So you know, you've been in a Rosser Group university, you've been in a number of different post-92 universities, and now you're at a very different kind of university, the University of Law. So well, you've only been a couple of months at the time we're doing the recording, but it is a different kind of university, isn't it? It's it's very much from very new, relatively new, but also very focused, and kind of has a range of bases around the country. So it's a different kind of institution, isn't it?
It is, and another privilege of working across the range of places I've worked in is you get to see different models of delivery, of the importance of research or teaching and other things that institutions do. So, yeah, I started in a Rosser Group university, firstly in Birmingham as a student and tutor as well, then into Queen's where I became a lecturer, and then moved around the university system in predominantly post-92s. One institution wasn't even a university at the time I joined. Roehampton was not a university when I first went there. It was Roehampton Institute of London, under the umbrella of Surrey University. And I was part of the process by which it gained university title. So yeah, I've seen lots of things, in part publicly funded institutions, and that's been a huge privilege. But now I'm in a private institution, and its university title is about 7 or 8 years old, but its history is actually over 150 years old.
Right.
Which most people don't realise, but I can't recall the exact name of the law firm that set it up, but it was set up by a law firm in, I think, 1872. And in that form, they were providing training and development for people that wanted to become solicitors. And then subsequent to that, from the College of Law gestation, which is about 1950, it became more legitimised as the College of Law, and then about 2013 as the University of Law. But it's a for-profit institution, and I know a lot of people feel uncomfortable about that. But what I would ask people to recognise is that any institution, whether it's private or part publicly funded, has to run itself as a business. There is a bottom line to be met, and you can't continue creating losses whether you're public or private, and it's no different for us. So as a private institution, we probably give a bit more priority to the importance of making sure we break even and make ends meet, but at the same time generate profit from that, which has the purpose of reinvestment and development and so on.
Yeah.
So the principles are the same. The way it's done is slightly different.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, also presumably some of those investment priorities will be different, right? So you're not going to look to use some of that profit to cross-subsidise research activity, for example.
No, it's a great, your comment is absolutely right. It's a great topic of interest at the university at the moment, because having come out of my own academic background, which is research and teaching, the interesting questions to me often is, what are we going to do about research? And there are people who want us to be research involved. But the realities are that research is a wonderful thing to be involved in. I think institutions and universities certainly should be doing research. But we have to be very careful in working out how we do that in a way which is cost effective, if we're going to do it, and will it be widespread and global? Not likely. So we will look at pockets of excellence that we can develop research capacity in, and then trying to find a way of externally funding that brings it as close to break even or modest surplus if we can. So, it's very different.
Yeah. Can you just give us a sense of scale of the institution and the locations? I haven't quite got a grasp of that.
No, it's something which people don't often know about. Our headcount number is somewhere around about 17,000.
Right.
Our FTE number is probably about 11 or 12,000 at the moment. I can't be exact on that, as it's very hard to count students in universities, as you know.
Yeah.
And we currently have 16 footprints. I say footprints because they're not all campuses.
Yeah.
But we have 13 physical sites in the UK. We have an online campus, which is increasing in size quite dramatically, and the pandemic has helped that. And we have a campus in Hong Kong and a campus in Berlin. So we're across those 16 different sites. And typically, we often have associated footprints with some of the Rosser Group universities. And the first of those that we set up was at Exeter University, where the conceptual law often delivered by Rosser Groups is supplemented by us delivering more contextual law. And so those marriages actually work quite well. So we now find ourselves on a number of institutional sites, often hosted by Russell Group universities, Exeter, Liverpool, and others.
Right. And of course, you've got a base in the city of Nottingham as well.
Which is where I've just come from. I've just travelled from the city centre out here to wonderful Nottingham University campus. And we're in the middle of the city there.
Yeah, excellent. Part of your career trajectory, again, as we mentioned earlier, is very much focused on supporting learning and teaching in UK higher education through your time at the Higher Education Academy. And that's something that you've expressed yourself very passionate about in a number of different locations over your years in the sector. And indeed, your inaugural lecture only last week at the University of Law was partly about your journey, but also about your passion for teaching. Do you want to say a bit more about that?
Yeah, look, it's... I mentioned earlier in this conversation that when I completed my degree in chemistry and maths, I became a teacher and I did a teaching qualification. So I had quite early on in my career developed an intimate understanding of what I often refer to as the philosophy, psychology and sociology of learning. And I've always held that as a very high principle in my involvement throughout academia, that research is wonderful. I love researching. It's fantastic. But the students are actually coming to us to entrust us in their learning journey for the award that they are seeking to get with us. And I think that's an important thing that we need to take greater responsibility for. And it's always been curious to me that in primary and secondary education in the UK, publicly funded, it's a requirement to have a teaching qualification. But when you get to university, there's no requirement for teaching qualifications to be held. And so when I became a DVC at Northumbria University, my portfolio was learning and teaching. It subsequently expanded to have a number of other things too, like international and so on. But the basis of the role was learning and teaching. And it wasn't at that point that I became passionate. I was already passionate, but through that role, and then when I took over as chief executive at the Higher Education Academy, my expressed desire was to try and find a way of raising the status of learning and teaching and the importance of having some recognition for the pedagogy that's required to deliver quality learning and teaching that staff could learn through the UK Professional Standards Framework or through institutions' own postgraduate cert in higher education or equivalent qualifications. And so I've always held these things very, very highly in the importance. And I know there's about 180,000 academics in the UK. When I first went to the HEA, about 25,000 of those had a qualification or a recognised fellowship from the HEA.
Yeah.
That number now sits at over 100,000.
Wow.
And I'm really, in my time, I think we got up to about 75,000. I'm really impressed with the fact that it's growing, that people are seeing the importance of this, that promotions criteria now are quite often recognising the importance of a teaching qualification or a fellowship or a postgraduate certificate in higher education. Raising the importance of the skills necessary to be able to become a competent teacher. And with learning technologies changing all the time, we need to recognise that some of the older models, the lecture theatre itself, the didactic delivery of content, really isn't the way that younger people engage with learning these days, and we need to finesse that a bit. So, yeah, I am hugely passionate about finding all sorts of ways to deliver positive learning. And some of them can be didactic. Some of them can be in a lecture theatre, but it can't always be that way. That's not how learning is going to be best taking place.
I completely agree with that. And I think one of the challenges coming out of the pandemic where, lots of things were forced, right? And lots of people had to adapt very, very quickly to adopt different learning and teaching approaches. One of the things coming out of it that you kind of suddenly realise, I think lots of people have realised, is that, and I don't mean learning styles. I mean, lots of people have different preferences in terms of how they engage with the teaching delivery that they want. So, some people will, like the traditional model, and others will much prefer never to see another human being in the flesh. Coping with that variety and finding ways to enable students to get the most out of their education whilst accepting that efficiencies mean you can't always deliver everything in just the way every individual likes is really tough, isn't it?
It's incredibly complex, and there is no easy answer, and that's the point you're making. If we take a typical lecture, 200 or 300 students in a lecture hall, there are going to be students in that room who will be very comfortable being able to absorb and learn through a didactic delivery. Yeah. There'll be others who will not be able to cope with that at all. And I think what the pandemic has enabled to happen in partly resolving that is that there's more video content now. There's more captioning of video content. And so not even just for students without disability, but for students with disability to be able to watch a video with captioning and have it replayed as many times as they want to enhances their learning in a way which was never possible before. If they were merely turning up to a live event that wasn't going to be repeated, where all sorts of compromises may have existed for them in terms of being able to observe learning in a positive way. So I think technology's got a great role to play. I still don't think we're anywhere near optimizing it in the way that it can be. But I think the pandemic enabled us to take a step forward in a big leap that had been happening much more slowly before that period of time.
Yeah.
And all universities have changed huge numbers of things during the pandemic around their technological support to learning.
Yeah, it is a bit unhelpful, though, I think, and you may not want to say anything about this, but it is a bit unhelpful to have the minister directing us suddenly that everything has to be in person and face to face. Having been applauded by her for our response to the pandemic, suddenly it's a complete switch around to that, which just strikes me as a bit odd, to be honest.
I think you're referring to the letter that Michelle Donlan sent on the 5th of May 2022, to timestamp this, that all of us perhaps were a little bit disappointed to read, because the commendation of the hard work that universities across the UK, and particularly England for her, did during the pandemic is commendable, and she notes that. But it's disingenuous, perhaps, to suggest that face-to-face is an absolute priority of a volume equivalent to what it was before the pandemic, when there were lots of ways of creating learning. And if we look at how many younger people engage with learning technologies these days, they often use tools and techniques that we slightly older people don't use.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if I said to you to find out some information, your mechanism for going to find that out technologically will be different to a person who's 18.
Absolutely.
And I think that point's being missed by the minister's letter at the moment, that we're doing lots of things which are creative and beyond the realms of what people are accustomed to. And that shouldn't be devalued merely for the purpose of saying face-to-face content hours have got to be the same as before.
Yeah, I completely agree. And of course, sending that letter at the start of the summer term, which is traditionally, how should we put it, more low-key in terms of face-to-face teaching, just it strikes me as a little strange. But we'll skate over that for now, if we may. We talk about often, you know, our sector facing, you know, challenges from government, from, you know, the environment, from each other, from competition within the sector, from, you know, from the economy and from the public and the media as well. I mean, if you were to kind of pick the biggest challenge facing our sector, not necessarily your university, but the sector, you know, what would be in your top 10 of biggest challenges facing the sector?
Yeah, good. I'm pleased you've given me a longer number because, you know, top one, I'm not sure. But I think some of the things you mentioned are significant concerns for me and higher education's future. I think we cannot be lacking sensitivity to concerns that young people have. And young people are concerned about climate emergencies. They're concerned about funding. They're concerned about debt. They're concerned about job prospects and employability. And so there is a tsunami of things in front of us at the moment that I think are really quite challenging.
Yeah.
And I've mentioned some of them there. I have long thought that we need to have a more grown-up debate about what universities are trying to achieve and what governments want universities to achieve. And that relates for me very much to the Tony Blair period of time as Prime Minister, where he wanted 50% of under 30s to go to university. It felt like an arbitrary number at the time. I think it needs to be explored again in terms of what is the right number of people who should be seeking academic qualifications at university level, not merely as a number, but rather what do we need people to be doing? And my attitude has always been that the pathway to work is not necessarily a university. It will be for some and quite a few, but others are apprenticeships, others are to directly leave school, others are through FE colleges. There are multiple pathways into work, and we've got to help people find the right one, for which university may or may not be right. And then there's the concept of readiness. So, you know, when is someone ready to go to university? One of my sons dropped out of school at 16, got himself a job, did very well for a few years, realised that he was probably going to have a limited career, decided to go back to university in his 20s. And I was very proud of him for doing that. So readiness is another concept that shouldn't be ignored in this discussion about what universities are trying to do and how we achieve that. But I think for me, probably one of the biggest challenges universities have got to face up to is the models that we've been using for over 800 years in a very, very similar form probably need to be rethought. I think there needs to be a really close inspection of how we deliver learning for the future that enables people to become competent lifelong learners, able to access information when they want to, build up qualifications when it's right and proper for them, with a funding model which doesn't cripple them or a government, and create sustainability. So there's an environmental issue, but there's also a pedagogic issue. And I think those two things probably have been dealt too much in separation up until now, and we probably need to bring them together.
I think that's a really fair point. I mean, the focus has often been on the, well, it has been on the economics of it. And, essentially, how do you fund a mass higher education system, regardless of what the detail looks like, how do you fund that system? And it's been to push more and more of that cost onto the student / graduate. And, it's about getting that balance right. I mean, I think there is probably now a general acceptance that graduates do need to contribute something to the cost of their education, but it's getting the balance right. At the moment, it looks unfair. But also, from a university's perspective, to provide the educational environment those students need, requires investment. And it's a difficult circle to square, but it comes back to what the nation needs. And I think you're absolutely right. It needs a kind of proper perspective on how we want to provide different routes of learning for our population. Yeah. And for some people, as you say, it will be an apprenticeship. For others, it will be a part-time accumulation later in life, which helps them as they progress towards a different kind of career. And, to give them a modicum of credit, the government's focus on, the lifelong learning entitlement is at least a step in that direction, which has got to be a good thing. It's unfortunate the rest of the picture is so difficult and messy. And I think your point about the Blair government's 50%, target is a good one. I mean, that's, been brought out again with the idea of actually raising that from the Blair Foundation. Mm. But it's very much, I think, about higher education in that broadest sense, rather than, the 18-year-old going to a full-time campus university experience. And I think that's, very much in tune with what you're saying, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Look, I've had the privilege, I'm sure you have as well, of being in graduation ceremonies and seeing graduates of all different ages. In fact, we graduated a student from the University of Law 3 weeks ago who was 80, had done a master's degree in medical ethics. And I thought, yeah, that's fantastic. Now, he's probably not going to go on and get a job after that, but he wanted to do that in his later life for reasons which I spoke with him about, which were very relevant. And I think the concept of readiness and the purpose behind it are things that we sometimes don't value as highly as we should. By putting metrics in place that say what is the value proposition for the student when they leave and the career they're going to have, the salary they start on and so on, they're not useful metrics for us to be discussing in terms of what is the value of higher education. But I'm a supporter of a user pay system. You heard earlier in my description here, I came to the UK and I was a user pays.
Yeah.
And a lot higher fees than students pay here. Now, I'm not saying that the figures are right in the UK. I think they need to be considered very carefully. I think that the damaging debt which students are leaving English higher education with at the moment is a cause for concern for most people. And I think the regime of repayment is, in my opinion, particularly unfair. I don't know why we're not merely asking students to repay the loan that they've had without interest, because it's better than what was happening before where there was no repayment. So even a repayment, which I realise is losing value, but without an interest charge seems a much fairer system that ought to be considered in terms of the redeployment of this. But yeah, I'm not making the policies on this. I'm not close to that sort of decision making. I think it's a very difficult discussion to have, and a very difficult situation to resolve. But with costs going up in all industries, but universities are no exception, we have to find a way of bringing in money that enables us to grow and develop as bodies of knowledge creation and knowledge transfer. At the same time as recognising that there are other parts of the community that also need funding and investment and development as well. And I don't have the answer.
I don't think any of us know the answer. But we talked about the cost of education. We talked about the learning and teaching experience that students have. There is another dimension of student life, the kind of wider student experience, which is very much part of a kind of traditional campus university experience, but you know, more generally in higher education. Now, sport is often a big part of that. I was just interested, given your background, Craig, on your views of the place of sport within a university environment. I mean, here at University of Nottingham, we're really passionate about it, both in terms of, you know, achievement, but also in terms of inclusivity, in making it as accessible to as many of our students as possible, because it brings wider benefits as well. So what's your take on university sport then?
Well, I hope you would expect that it's a very positive one. I know you're director of sport, and I'm currently in a privileged position of being the chairperson of the British Universities and Colleges Sport, which oversees inter-university competition in the UK. And I'm really proud to be in that position and to be seeing the great work that Bucks does and that universities do, and your university is exceptional in its performance outcomes. In Bucks competition, we did some research a couple of years ago through Bucks on the impact of university sport on the leadership and life careers that students have beyond university. And there is compelling evidence which shows that students that involve themselves in sport and physical activity, particularly competitive sport at university, go on to have more fulfilling lives and more influential roles in leadership in their later careers. So the correlation is really high. Now, as I said earlier, yeah, we've got 180,000 staff working in higher education as academics. We've got about 2.3 million students. Over 110,000 of those are playing sport in inter-university competition. I'd like to get more of them involved in inter-university competition, but if not, I'd like to get them involved in physical activity and exercise. And this is where universities, particularly campus universities like yours, have got a big role to play, because putting sporting facilities on your campus and having students have access to those, encouraging them to be involved in them, either on a recreational level or a semi-competitive level. You know, lots of universities like yours will have inter-hall competitions between your accommodation groups, as well as those who are at a better standard who are playing into university competition. And we are a catalyst for these people going on to Commonwealth Games representation, Olympic Games representation, and professional sport. And we are extremely proud of the fact that through Bucks last year in the delayed Summer Olympic Games, if we had been a nation, Bucks sport, in other words, people in universities across the UK would have finished fifth in the league table of medals. Fantastic. So there's a lot of students who are performing at the highest level, but also studying. And for me, that's just wonderful. And I, when I left Australia, that wasn't a system they had in place. They've got something similar now. But I've often looked at the American model and thought, oh, gosh, how stunning is that? And I've had a bit to do with Kentucky University, who has a massive sports program.
Yeah.
You know, an 80,000-seater football stadium, a 20,000-seater season ticket-only basketball stadium, and they are the most successful basketball team, men's basketball team in U.S. collegiate history. And you look at those sort of things, you think, wow. Well, I think, wow.
Yeah.
But we can't do that here, and I'm not trying to do that here. I think what we've got is a gentle regime of appropriateness, but we need to make sure we maintain it. So I think it's great that universities like Nottingham are heavily involved in this, and Dan's been a great supporter of Bucks and the things that we do. And you know, there's a great future ahead for universities that do that, in my opinion.
Yeah, and of course, you know, coaches in the US are paid a downside yes. more than vice chancellors.
They are. That's exactly right. Yeah. Well, the last time I looked at the accounts at the University of Kentucky, their sporting program was actually spending more money than their academic program. And that's quite typical. They're not an Ivy League, but that's quite typical of the Ivy League universities, which is where sport came from. The Ivy League was created out of sport, and then it went into academia and research as its priority. But it does all three of those things very, very well.
But that's a bit frightening as well. But I think it's, I mean, I think we where we are with sport in UK higher education is good.
I do.
And really positive. But I completely endorse your comments there. I mean, it seems to me it's an absolutely essential part of that wider student experience, which adds enormous value both for the student and for the environment that they're living in.
Well, and when we think about the past 2 years, which have brought to the surface what something existed previously, which is the mental health and well-being of students particularly, sport has a real supportive effect and levelling effect on mental health and well-being. So all universities, and I know they will be, through their freshers and their induction events, should be encouraging students to get involved in these sorts of things, because that's where you meet people, that's where your support systems get created from. There are other ways of doing it, but clubs and societies and sport play a big role to play in giving those students that support system for when things aren't going so well.
Yeah. So do you think that will help with England's next Ashes attempt?
Well, you can only do your best, can't you?
That bad, eh? So, Craig, can I just ask you on your perspective of the relationship between registrars and vice-chancellors?
It's a good question. Look, the senior leadership of any institution has got to work together in a collaborative form, though we may not always agree. And I think the registrar role, which here I understand your role quite specifically and the broad range of things that you're involved in, the VC and registrar have got to get on well and have shared thinking on things, though there'll be difference of opinion and you work out how to ameliorate that and reach a common ground. And ultimately, and not to take any position of power here, ultimately the well-being of the university through its leadership rests with the VC. Yeah. So sometimes the VC will say, well, we're not doing that, we're doing this. And I think that's okay, but it shouldn't happen regularly. It should be a process by which we can reach agreement from all the senior team, in fact. And you know, you've often had a quite large senior team here from what I recall. And so there'll be a lot of opinions to put into that mix. You know, coming back to you personally, I think one of the great things that I see in you here is the longevity of time you've had in this role. So you bring with yourself a degree of institutional history, which is important in working out how decisions can be made without making mistakes of the past. And that's important.
Craig, we need to stop there, but thanks ever so much for a really great conversation. I've really enjoyed catching up. It's been absolutely super.
Thanks, Paul.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.